Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelow. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. Time now for our Tech Talk segment on WATD on the South Shore's Morning News. I'm Rob Hackelow with the morning team every week. At this time, we check in with our tech guy, David Snell, AxSmart IT in Wareham. David, good morning.
And good morning to you, Rob.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you? After the eclipse, everything's good?
Yeah, it was good. Did you guys watch it in your area?
We watched it from Wareham. It was very cool.
it was fun to see. Yeah, I bet it was probably more exciting in the totality area, but it is what it is. I still enjoyed
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, here we are. This is kind of a follow-up, David, right to something we had talked about, and this was about Google and their Chrome browser, this incognito mode, which wasn't so private in reality, right?
It was not incognito at all, actually. For years, Google simply told the users that Internet browser, you've gone incognito, and now you can browse privately, but it was not, in fact, the case. It turns out that due to a court filing on Monday, April 1st, April Fool's Day, actually, they admitted to the fact that they have billions of bits of data on everyone who used incognito mode.
Mm-hmm. So they would end up collecting, because I imagine they probably would collect more. Maybe some people said that they were using this as an option, and they ended up just giving their information anyway.
Exactly right. And the thing about it is that many people use incognito mode because they didn't want their information to be recorded or tracked. And Google made us believe that that's exactly what was happening. But part of the remediation is that they're required to delete all the information from private browsing data and not do it again to anyone in incognito. They've also changed the incognito homepage. When you go into incognito mode, mm-hmm. it tells you now that, yes, we can see your data, your ISP can see your data, your school can see your data, lots of people can see the data that's not incognito.
So what is the, I don't even get, why do they even do incognito mode anymore?
Well, because some people won't listen to what we're talking about today.
Oh, okay.
And they'll
still go for it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, all right. Exactly.
All right, so that makes sense. Okay, so they did get in trouble for this, but they didn't have to pay anything, right? Is it, or?
Yeah, there was no monetary restitution. It okay. was just the fact that they have to actually block third-party cookies within Chrome's incognito mode for 5 years. I'm not sure why they have a five-year limit on that. And then they also have to delete those billions of data bits that they have saved on all the folks that ever used incognito mode.
Okay. So, I mean, that in a sense, I imagine that could be worth money.
Yeah, absolutely, because they say that they were just using it for advertising.
Wow. All right.
But, you know, they weren't supposed to do it anyway, so.
Yeah, so now the new incognito mode is you go there, and it is clear, though, if you go to it, is the wording different?
Yeah, the page where it says you've gone incognito says it's very different than what it did in the past when it said you were private, you can surf the web privately. Now they say that they won't save your browsing information or your cookies or site data, but information entered in forms, websites you visit, your employer or school, and internet service providers can view this activity.
Okay. So now incognito mode, this is the new incognito mode from Google, where now you imagine that you have privacy. That's what they're hoping you do, because that's what it sounds like that was the only thing that they were doing last time, is you imagine that you have privacy in your own head.
Right. That's right. But you don't really, so be careful what you do incognito.
Yay.
With what you do regular normal browser. So.
All right. So, just like everything with these businesses, they got to get caught and somebody's got to expose that, and then they apologize, and then we go on. But there was, in this case, this was a lawsuit, as you mentioned. So where does it kind of go from here?
Well, we're not sure what any of these private browser modes are going to do for now, moving forward, because now that Google's been grabbed, you know, everybody else has to look at what their splash page says when you go into private mode. Because it's nothing's private on the internet. No matter what they tell you, it's not private.
Yeah, and I guess that's something that eventually the government does seem to get involved is with when we start to use, and companies have done this before, whether it be diet or remember the word light to describe certain things, where we just the product and whatever it is, we understand why they're using it, but it's usually to fool you in a sense, I think. And that's when you put the word private out there, again, there's a certain expectation, right?
Exactly, and we didn't have that privacy in private browsing mode. So it was interesting that even some of the employees were deposed during this trial, and they came up saying things, you know, we need to stop calling it incognito and stop using that spy guy icon. Another Google employee said, changing the splash page to say you are not protected from Google. Just, you know, these are employees who had a little more, I guess, upstanding values.
Yeah. I mean, they could feel like, you know, hey, you know, we're fooling people, and this is not a good thing. And you know, eventually, it's going to come back to get us. And I guess in this case, it did. So
it has. Yep.
let's see. As far as other companies, Dave, are there other browsers that are better for privacy?
Rob, I don't believe that any of them are private browsers.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, I was wondering if all of them do this, but maybe they don't try to fool you. They just, you know, they don't have something as something like incognito or private mode.
Right, and saying that it's private.
Yeah.
You know, everything you do from your computer out to the internet goes to an internet service provider or multiple internet service provider hops. So there's plenty of places for that data to be grabbed and stored and used or misused in anyone's ability to do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, David, you've got the latest here on some of the different responses and the different takes from different articles and sources, right? It's all part of your blog?
Yeah, I've got NPR, The Wall Street Journal, Wired Magazine, and one of my favorites, The Verge. Everyone's talking about it. No one's happy about it. But it looks like we're on the right track for at least the next 5 years. We'll see what happens when that 5-year period is up.
Yeah, what is that 5-year? I guess we'll have to we'll come back and talk about it, I guess. But, what is the 5-year? I mean, I guess maybe we'll revisit the word privacy. Maybe in 5 years it'll have a different meaning. I don't know.
That's right.
All right. Google's Chrome browser, private or not, probably not. And it sounds like most others aren't either. Check it all out. David, where do people go to read more?
Let's go to xsmartit.com and click on my blog link. And it's private. You can go there privately.
Oh, nice. xsmartit.com. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Rob.
Bye-bye. xsmartit.com, xsmartit.com. David Snell is with us every week at this time on WATD. Time now to check in with our favorite bank guy, Bob Taravecchia. Bob is the chair and CEO of Coastal Heritage Bank. He joins us every week at this time. And this segment presented by Coastal Heritage Bank. One community, many individuals, one bank that's perfect for you. Coastal Heritage Bank, growing together, member FDIC, member DIF. Bob, good morning.
Robert, Christine, how are we doing today?
Good morning. So
good
glad to hear from
you.
Yeah.
Good to be heard. Last week I was a little tied up, Rob. I texted Rob in the middle of the night. I had a hot tooth, Christine.
Nothing's
go see Dr.
worse.
Yankum, and Dr. Yankum did the job and pulled that tooth, and I was in excruciating pain. I'm a baby, though. I will submit to the audience that I'm a baby. So what I say is painful is probably not.
No, anything.
Tooth related,
forget it.
It's that.
It's awful.
Anything to,
you can't get away from
pain,
it.
You can't do anything to really.
No.
You know, once it's there, yeah. I know what you mean. It's not like you can just, you know, get inside there and rub a nerve. You know, like I mean, yeah. Well, you know, you got an itch or you got some other pain. You know, maybe you can put water on it or ice or something. But tooth pain, it just is like just it's stabbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in any event,
omnipresent.
I'm glad Dr. Yankum took care of that issue. And Bob is back with us now.
And speaking of hot teeth, hot CPI came out yesterday, you know,
oh,
speaking
right.
of hot. The Consumer Price Index was the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They published their March data, and the markets were not very happy about it. Particularly the stock market did not react well to it, and the bond market reacted negatively as well as it relates to maybe, you know, where we think rates are going to go. But the core CPI was at 3.8%, which was higher than we thought. The overall CPI was 3.5% year over year. So that just means of a basket of goods and services that the government tracks, those goods and services last year were 3.5% less expensive than they are today year over year. In February, the number was 3.2%. So it actually went up a little bit, which is a little confounding to the Federal Reserve, who are tracking this data. And as we've talked about many times, you know, Jerome Powell has said he's data-driven. But this is data that would probably suggest that when they meet again in May, which is May 1st, when the FOMC convenes to discuss the Fed funds rate, they're probably more likely than not, probably very more likely than not, that they will not change interest rates. They will not lower them. Which is, you know, the conventional wisdom coming into this year was that the Fed was, inflation was now, you know, more or less under control, and that the Fed was going to start lowering interest rates and kind of easing monetary policy to navigate a soft landing. It seems to be that this inflation is, I think the words they use is stubborn. And I just want to break it down a little bit, you know, in maybe some of the underlying items that are driving this inflation data. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an interesting one. So car insurance, we all know this because I just renewed mine. Car insurance overall nationally up 22%. So you say to yourself, why is that? Well, let's go back. Remember a couple years ago during the pandemic, do you remember talking to people about what was happening with the price of cars? They were going up.
Yeah.
Right? Remember that? You couldn't get a used car because the new cars were shut down. So used cars, or as the car guy would say, previously owned vehicles, selling for substantially a cream puff, Rob.
Yeah, and
selling
people didn't.
Substantially, right?
People wanted to start carpooling and taking buses, and some people wanted to drive because of the, you know, the virus or whatever. But yeah, there was just the demand to have more vehicles.
Correct. And so as the price of cars goes up, when one gets in an accident and the insurance company has to give replacement value for that vehicle, if the replacement value of the vehicle now is higher, they have to pay out more. So it's a lag, you know, and the point I'm trying to make is that car insurance is sort of lagging 12 to 24 months behind when car prices went up. Similarly with home insurance, you know, you get home insurance is much more expensive today. Now, some people will say it's because, you know, there's more storms and all that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that a house that cost $300,000 10 years ago is now $600,000. So if there's a problem in that home, it's covered by insurance. In order to get replacement of the whatever it was that happened to the house, it's more expensive. So as inflation gets into the system, it kind of finds its way into every little nook and cranny of the economy. And it just isn't in one little pocket. Car repairs, another one, up 8%. Rent, up 6%. Electricity, 5%. Now, you know, we all know that the cost of fuel to generate electricity has gone up, a lot of it because of energy policy in the country, trying to transition within a very short period of time from cheap fuels to more expensive renewables that cost more money. It's inflationary to generate those electrons that we all take for granted. Mm-hmm. As time goes on, another thing that happened yesterday, so as a result of this CPI going up, some of the longer-term interest rates went up as well. So the 10-year treasuries went up over, it's almost 4.6%, which is the highest level that it's been in November. So what does that mean? Well, fixed-rate, 30-year fixed-rate mortgages generally track the 10-year treasury. So if that goes up, those rates are going to go up just in time for the buying season, for the spring buying season. The few houses that are out there on the market, interest rates will now be even higher because of this. So I think the takeaway is that I think rates are going to remain higher for longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, this inflation, and, you know, the Fed says that they want to get inflation down to 2%.
Yeah.
And it's, I think we may have to settle for the fact that they may have to just move the goalpost and say 3 to 4 is going to be fine. You know, there's so many things that are inflationary that are going against what the Fed's trying to do. You know, I'll leave you with one other little statistic here. The U.S. debt in Washington, you know, the debacle that both parties have brought upon every generation of the United States citizenry, it goes up $1 trillion every 100 days is what we've been averaging. So every 100 days, our government, our federal government, spends $1 trillion more than it takes in. And in 2017, the national debt was $20 trillion, and it's almost, if we keep on the current pace, next year, it'll be $40 trillion. So in 8 years, we will have doubled the national debt. And that's during peacetime.
Wow.
That is during peacetime when we're not, you know, so how sustainable is that? The interest we pay on our debt is now more than, greater than our national security, what we pay on defense. So there's a lot of inflationary news out there. I don't see it getting better in the short term.
I'm sorry. That's
what was that?
That's the kick the can party.
Hey, Bob, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Well, first, quick comment, quick question. Weren't they expecting the rate, the consumer price index, to be more like 3.4%? Wasn't that expected?
Yes.
So that was a little surprise. But when they figure out what it is, do they always go for the same things? Is it like 10 things they look at? It's sort of like the, you know, like the Dow Jones has the specific stocks.
Yep.
How many things do they look at?
That's a great question. I don't know specifically, but it's a basket. There's a basket of goods and services. They're generally consistent. They do recalibrate it over time because, let's say, 30 years ago, right, there wasn't cell phones. So cell phones may not be in the underlying data 30 years ago. It is today. So electronics and so forth. So they do change it over time.
Okay.
But just like the Dow Jones 30, Christine, that's a great question. If you go back and look at, I think GE is the only original Dow Jones company that existed. And I think what they do is over time, as they take companies out or add new companies, there's an algorithm they use to kind of level set it on a go forward basis, so it could be, so you can compare apples to apples. But that's a great question. They do recalibrate it based on new goods and services that emerge in the economy.
Thank you. You think the stock market's going to calm down over the next couple of weeks?
You know, I really can't predict
the
stock market. You know what I mean?
Not going to stop me from asking,
though. Christine.
No.
I do know one thing. You know, in 2019, eggs were about $2 a gallon, $2 a dozen, and now they're about $4 a dozen. So, I know, Christine, because I've seen you in the supermarket, and I do the shopping, too.
That's right.
It's a hell of a lot more expensive than it used to be, you know?
Absolutely.
All right. So, well,
more to come.
Bob Terravecchia, Coastal Heritage Bank. He's with us every Thursday at this time on WATD. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, gang. Take care.
Bye-bye. It's time now for our South Shore Chamber of Commerce segment. We do it every week after the 8:30 news. And in studio with us this week, we have Peter Foreman. Peter is the president and CEO of the South Shore Chamber of Commerce. Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Rob. Busy week at the Chamber. We are helping support the annual employment law update held by Murphy, Hesse, Toomey, and Lehane. We are almost into 50 years of this employment law update, and I can tell you the law has gotten a lot more complicated. My guest this morning, I thought it would be interesting to talk a little bit about some trends in employment law. They spend an entire half day doing it Thursday. We'll spend about 8 minutes. But my guest is Nan O'Neill, who is a partner at Murphy, Hesse, Toomey, and Lehane, and a longtime leader in the Chamber's Human Resource Group, which helps small businesses navigate some of these very complicated areas.
Nan O'Neill, good morning.
Good morning, Rob. Nice to meet you. Nice to be with you today.
Yeah, thanks for coming in studio to join us here on the South Shore Chamber segment. So tell me, I know you've been a longtime employee, a longtime partner with this firm, and you're also an employment law specialist. So let's talk about employment law. You mentioned it can be complicated. So how long has Murphy Hesse been running the employment law update, and how has it evolved over the years?
Oh, gosh. We were walking down memory lane in the firm yesterday, and I think it's 40-plus years that there's been some iteration of the employment law update. We've been partnering with the South Shore Chamber to do this probably almost 40 years now. And you know how it's evolved over the years is, you know, it started out, the lawyers would be talking heads, talking about court cases. But over the years, what we've tried to do is put our finger on the pulse of the hot topics. What do employers want to hear about? What are human resources people struggling with day in and day out? And so we have four modules now with hot employment topics.
Wow. Okay. And now Murphy, Hesse, Toomey, and Lehane has been a well-known law firm of the South Shore for decades. I think many people think of you as a law firm that specializes in employment law. You mentioned that's a big part of it, but you do a lot of work in other areas. So tell us a little bit about the firm and what you guys do.
Sure, sure. We're about 30 lawyers, and the originators have been practicing together for 50-plus years. So the firm in its current iteration is almost 40 years old. In addition to employment, we do employee benefits, public and private, ERISA work. We represent, we have an education practice where we represent K through 12, higher ed, public and private. We do municipal law. We act as town council for many municipalities. We have a litigation practice, litigation that spawns out of all those areas. We cover that. And finally, we have a corporate practice where we assist small to medium-sized businesses, corporate governance, business formation. So it's a really very general practice with some specialty areas.
Now, Nan, this is a very interesting area here to get to because this affects everybody. There's been a lot of interest in talk about artificial intelligence. I really want to get your take on this and what that means for our work and lives. So how is it affecting work and employment law? Because I imagine this has happened in other areas because we've talked about sometimes technology or things come around first and then we come up with laws to deal with it. So tell me about what you guys are going through.
Sure. I mean, good intro, Rob, because I think with respect to AI, artificial intelligence, many employers think, and the business community thinks, oh, there's no laws. We're waiting for this, like, federal omnibus legislation, right?
Yeah.
The reality is there's plenty of laws. There's plenty of existing laws that apply to AI and how employers deploy it in the workplace. And that's what you really have to be mindful of. And,
okay.
I think one thing with
so it's not all the Wild West.
It's not the Wild West. So I've heard it characterized as the Wild West, right? I mean, you know, if I can give you an example, if I may, there's a huge employer in Massachusetts. First of all, let me step back.
Yep.
Massachusetts has had a lie detector law since 1988. That law prohibits employers from doing lie detector tests on employees or applicants, okay?
Oh, okay.
All right. Big employer in Massachusetts subjects its applicants to a AI video interviewing tool.
Oh.
That tool is set up, it evaluates facial expressions, voice intonations, eye contact to determine whether or not applicants have so-called integrity.
Mm.
All right? There's a class action suit against that employer right now saying the use of that AI tool violates the Massachusetts lie detector statute, which has been around since 1988.
No, but that's fascinating because I figured they probably could say, you know, but it wasn't a lie detector machine. But was it?
Yeah. And the statute is really interesting. It doesn't say lie detector machine. It says a device that can detect whether or not somebody is being honest, whether or not somebody has a propensity to lie. So I think as a lawyer, you know, what our job is to say, hey, listen, these are great resources, right? They can help employers screen resumes. They can help employers with performance management. But you have to do it in the context of the existing laws. Like, how can this get you into trouble? And you know, one of the ways it can get employers into trouble is screen out, for example, individuals with disabilities because maybe they can't participate in maybe somebody's sight impaired or hearing impaired. Maybe it screens out individuals of a particular race, color, national origin, religion. That's what you have to be careful of.
Wow. I think this is fascinating. Peter, you agree?
I'm wondering who sued a company that they weren't hired because they were lying on artificial intelligence, and they sued because of that. Because they were liars and caught at it.
The integrity machine screened me out. But, I don't know. It's interesting. You're right. I mean, I suppose you all of a sudden.
I don't think anyone has a right to lie, right? Is that
free speech? It doesn't have to be true.
Well, I know with employment, you know, we were talking about remember the whole strike with SAG, and I can say, you know, not necessarily here at this radio station, but the union is, you know, they didn't want their work, the workers being replaced by artificial intelligence.
Right.
So, I mean, there's still a lot to navigate, right?
Right. That's right. And I think that all of the pending laws both at the federal and the state level. And actually, at the state level, there's a piece of legislation that came out of the state house, an act to prevent a dystopian work environment. That's the name of the state legislation. But really what it does is says, hey, employers, if you want to use AI, you can. Mm-hmm. But you have to do an assessment impact. You have to vet it. You have to tell your employees. And it has to be double-checked with human interaction. So you look at this law and you see governments at the state and federal level struggling with, okay, how can we deploy this great resource, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to save time and increase efficiency. But how do we make sure it doesn't trample on individual rights? And that's the balance.
Are we having AI write any laws yet, or you have any AI law clerking for you?
Well, you know, the famous case in New York, right, where the lawyers cited cases that ChatGPT had made up. So
it's incredible. It seems to be going faster. But you're saying obviously, if you are a business owner, there are some laws out there that you really do need to be aware of, and that's where somebody would go to you to make sure, are we doing this the right way?
What should we be aware of? What should we think about? I mean, I also want to point out, and this goes a little bit beyond the legal, but it sort of justifies, you know, this proposed legislation that says you need to have humans check this, you know, do a check to make sure nobody's being excluded. MIT researchers tested a visual interviewing tool, and they set it up so one of the criteria being evaluated was English proficiency of a candidate. Okay, the tool said this candidate was competent in English. The candidate got a ranking of 6 out of 9.
All right.
Candidate spoke only German, 100% German, during the entire interview, and the AI tool evaluated that German speaker as, you know, competent in English.
So you
just have to think, like, how accurate are these tools? And I'm not suggesting that all tools aren't accurate, but what I'm suggesting is there needs to be a human check, right?
Yeah, that's why I'm not ready to go in the autonomous vehicle and let it drive myself while I take a nap yet. I'm not quite there. Nan.
So this is tax filing deadline. Is there something analogous here with all of the tax software and people doing tax returns using these software programs for years to calculate it? They're still responsible to check what was spit out and pay the taxes.
And that's a great point, Peter, because just because you have tax software that does it doesn't mean you're off the hook if there's a mistake, right? And the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, what they have been very clear about is that if your AI tool makes a mistake, you, the employer, are still liable. So, you know, you can't hide behind the so-called black box, right? And what the EEOC is recommending employers do is go to those service providers, those vendors, and say, where'd you get your data?
Yeah.
Did you test your data? Did you make sure it doesn't screen out people of particular races and, you know, national origins?
Wow.
So that would be an interesting conversation with vendors, right?
It's a scary new world.
I know, but this was great. I'm so glad, Peter, you brought Nan. And Nan O'Neill, it's been great to have you in studio this morning. So people can find out more at MHTL.com. That's your firm's website, right?
That's right.
It's Murphy, Hesse, Toomey, and Lehane. And they are located in Braintree. And, of course, if you want to find out more about the South Shore Chamber, that is southshorechamber.org. Peter Foreman.
Great. And we have lots of resources to help small businesses. Many chambers do help small businesses with this employment law quagmire that they often get into. May 8th, our human resource group is going to have an open forum for HR people. And they don't have to be HR professionals. They can be the people in small businesses who are handling HR, which often happens to be the people doing the bookkeeping because you got to deal with payroll and benefits. And a couple weeks before that, April 25th, we have our Coffee Connections at South Shore Stars in Weymouth. So the pace is picking up with activity.
I like it. All right. Well, Nan and Peter, thank you so much for coming in studio today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Nice to be here.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9WATD.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9WATD.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.